You know, we often hear about these huge infrastructure projects, right? Miles of track, new stations, lots of concrete. But what if one was, well, maybe less about the steel and more about nurturing the soul of a community? In this deep dive, we're going to explore how the Blue Line Extension Project in the Twin Cities metro area is trying to do just that. It's not just about connecting places, but also actively working to prevent displacement and, you know, preserve the identity of the neighborhoods it touches. We're pulling from a pretty detailed report on their anti-displacement strategies and also some really good notes from a community group that's deeply involved. So get ready for, I think, a fascinating look at how urban planning and cultural preservation can really intertwine, what it actually means to build community prosperity.
Okay, so to kick things off, let's get the basics down. The Blue Line Extension, how big are we talking, and what's its main goal, really?
Yeah, it's definitely significant. It's 13.4 miles long.
13 miles, okay. And it comes with 13 brand new stations. The main aim, to link up Minneapolis, Robbinsdale, Crystal, and Brooklyn Park. It's designed for fast, frequent, all-day service right across the existing metro system.
So that means, like, you can get on and go straight downtown or to the airport without changing.
Exactly. A single-seat ride to downtown Minneapolis, MSP Airport, even the Mall of America, connecting right into the existing Blue Line stops. But what's really interesting here, I think, is the explicit focus on building community prosperity and doing that through anti-displacement strategies. And they're thinking about this before construction, during it, and after it wraps up. That kind of commitment right up front isn't something you always see.
No, definitely not. That focus on community first is pretty compelling. So, with a project this big, where are they actually at? Is it still just lines on a map, or is stuff happening on the ground?
Oh, it's well beyond just the initial blueprints now. Several key stages are already done, things like the exact alignment, where the stations will be located, the typical sections like how wide the lanes and sidewalks will be, that's all finalized, and the preliminary plans. They're prepared.
Okay, so the groundwork is laid, conceptually at least.
Right. And looking ahead, May through July 2025, that period involves refining those details, the typical sections, platform designs, shelters, park and ride plans, traffic stuff, and also, crucially, the environmental mitigation measures. That's all happening next year.
And then.
Then 2026 is when things really ramp up. Station architectural design, lighting, landscaping, how retaining walls or noise walls might look if they're needed. And of course, the detailed construction planning really kicks into high gear then.
Makes sense. And those 13 stations, how are they spread out? Is it fairly even across the different cities?
It seems pretty well distributed. Brooklyn Park is getting five stations. Crystal gets one. Robbinsdale has one. Plus, it shares the Lowry Avenue station with Minneapolis. And Minneapolis gets five stations of its own, also sharing that Lowry Avenue stop. So, yeah, it covers the whole corridor pretty effectively.
Now, you mentioned anti-displacement. When most of us hear that, I think we immediately jump to, rising rents, people getting priced out. Is that the main focus here, or is it broader?
That's a really important question. Housing cost is definitely a huge piece of it, but it's not the whole picture. The sources kind of break displacement down into different types. So first, there's what you just described, direct displacement. That's when residents literally can't afford their homes anymore because costs go up. Or they might be forced out directly. Maybe their lease isn't renewed, or there are evictions, sometimes eminent domain for the project itself. Or homes just become uninhabitable, often because investors are eyeing redevelopment.
Right, the sort of classic gentrification pressure.
Exactly. But then there's also indirect displacement. This one's a bit more subtle, sometimes called exclusionary displacement. It happens when, say, lower-income residents move out for whatever reason, maybe natural turnover, but then other lower-income residents simply can't move in to replace them.
Ah, because prices have already climbed.
Precisely. Prices have gone up, or maybe policies have changed, or sometimes middle-income folks just move into those spots instead. So the neighborhood's affordability profile changes over time, even without direct force-outs.
Okay, direct and indirect. Got it. But you mentioned there were three types. The sources highlighted a third one that sounds different. What is it, and why is it so relevant for a transit project like this?
Yeah, the third type, and this one is often overlooked but maybe foundational, is cultural displacement.
Cultural displacement.
Right. This happens as the residential makeup changes.
Yeah.
You start seeing shops and services shift, catering more to the newer, often wealthier residents. The whole character, the feel of the neighborhood, starts to transform, and the people who've lived there a long time, even if they manage to stay in their homes, they can start to feel, well, disconnected, alienated, even neglected, like the place isn't for them anymore.
That really hits home. feeling like a stranger in your own neighborhood.
Exactly. And here's a critical point the report makes. This feeling, this cultural displacement, making existing communities feel unwelcome, it often actually comes before the physical displacement.
Yeah.
You can sort of pave the way for it, making it easier for physical displacement to happen later. It's a fundamental shift in who the community feels it belongs to.
Wow. Okay, so if that's the challenge, the subtle erosion of belonging, how does a big infrastructure project even begin to fight that? How do you address something as, well, intangible as cultural identity?
That's where this concept of using cultural placekeeping comes into play.
Cultural placekeeping, all right.
It's defined basically as a tool to prevent that cultural displacement. The idea is to actively anchor the community's identity using visible symbols, emotional connections, things that create a really deep sense of belonging that tie people strongly to that specific place. It's about being proactive, not reactive.
So strengthening the existing ties.
Precisely. And there's a connection to the bigger picture, too. The thinking is, when residents don't feel that sense of belonging, that attachment, city governments might actually be less likely to invest properly in that community, and they might be more likely to create public spaces that feel exclusive, not welcoming to everyone who lives there.
I see the link.
The project documents also mention cultural corridors. This is about using local arts and culture within a specific area as a way to foster equitable development. Think of them as placemaking projects, but specifically using cultural heritage as a springboard for more economic investment. It really highlights how interconnected culture and physical infrastructure can be.
That makes a lot of sense. It sounds like a really holistic approach, but are there actual concrete steps? How do you translate cultural placekeeping into action items for building a light rail line? It seems like a huge challenge.
Yeah, it's definitely ambitious, but they do have specific recommendations from the anti-displacement work group. First, like we just touched on, actively use that cultural heritage to attract further economic investment. Don't just preserve it, leverage it. Second, make sure everyone sees how linked the cultural and physical infrastructure are. They aren't separate things. Third, develop a really coordinated action plan specifically for anti-displacement. The focus has to be on keeping the existing rich culture of the corridor strong and actually enhancing it so it thrives long term.
Okay, those are the goals. What about the how?
Right, the how. That brings us to the fourth recommendation, which is crucial. The cultural placekeeping process itself. This involves setting up specific cultural placekeeping design groups. And these aren't just token committees. They need to actively bring in local residents, business owners, cultural organizations, people from the community. The whole point is to make sure the design of the light rail, the stations, the landscaping, everything truly respects, reflects, and even celebrates the diverse cultures already there, using their stories, their traditions.
So the community isn't just consulted, they're actively shaping the design.
Exactly. It means working together to figure out what are the key cultures and histories in each city along the line. How can the LRT design reflect that? Who should be represented? How can the look and feel genuinely honor both existing cultures and past histories? It's about co-creation.
That idea of co-creation is powerful. So if the community is helping design it, where would we actually see this cultural expression? On a practical level, where does it show up along a light rail line?
They thought about that quite specifically. They call them opportunity areas.
Okay.
So right there on the station platform, you can see it reflected in things like the wayfinding signs, maybe using specific motifs or languages. Also in the fences, the handrails, the color palettes used, the patterns, textures, even interpretive signage telling local stories.
So embedded right into the functional parts.
Yes. And then off the platform, too. It could extend to the landscaping choices, banners hanging nearby, fencing designs. Even something as mundane as utility cabinets could potentially reflect local culture. The idea is to weave it into the very fabric of the physical stuff, not just, you know, tacking on a mural at the end.
Right. Not just decoration, but integration. To make this even clearer for you listening, let's look at a specific example our sources mentioned. How is one particular organization actually putting this into practice?
Yeah, there's a great example, Asian Media Access, or AMA. They've been really, really active in this whole cultural placekeeping initiative. Their focus is making sure this Blue Line extension actually builds prosperity for the existing community, that it doesn't lead to displacement. They've become a major voice for strategies that protect people already there while still encouraging positive economic development.
And how are they engaging with this cultural placekeeping idea specifically?
Well, they've really embraced it as a way to fight that cultural displacement we talked about. Now that the project is moving towards detailed architectural design, AMA is right there, working hard to establish these cultural placekeeping design groups we mentioned. They want to ensure the visual elements, the look and feel, truly honor and celebrate the Pan-Asian cultures and histories along that corridor.
So what does that look like on the ground?
It means they're advocating for specifics, like culturally relevant designs on wayfinding panels, pushing for certain colors, patterns, textures that resonate with the diverse Asian communities there, and making sure interpretive signs tell the stories of those communities. It gets down to those really tangible details.
That sounds very hands-on.
Very. Their vision even includes potentially fostering a Pan-Asian cultural district along the Blue Line route, with coordinated efforts to maintain and even enhance the existing culture, so it doesn't just survive the construction, but actually thrives afterward. It's a really comprehensive approach. They see the Blue Line extension not just as transit, but as a potential tool for preserving culture, empowering the community, and creating lasting economic opportunities, all while keeping that sense of identity in place intact.
So we've really dug into the Blue Line extension today, and it's revealed how a major infrastructure project can be designed very differently, not just for moving people, but maybe as a groundbreaking model for community-focused development, using this idea of cultural placekeeping. It feels like a significant shift, doesn't it? Moving from just building through communities to actually trying to build with them.
Definitely. It's a different philosophy.
And I think the key takeaway here for you listening is that preventing displacement, it really goes beyond just worrying about housing costs, as important as that is. It also involves actively working to preserve and celebrate the unique cultural identity of a place, making sure that the community feels anchored, feels empowered, feels like the place still belongs to them.
That sense of belonging is key.
Absolutely. So here's a final thought to leave you with. As you think about this, how might this whole concept of cultural placekeeping apply to other big public projects? Maybe not just transit, but parks, libraries, developments in your own community. And maybe what role could you or people like you play in helping define what really makes a place feel like home, something to mull over?